Hello and welcome to Monocle 24's The Urbanist, the show all about the cities we live in. I'm Andrew Tuck. On this week's episode,
we thought to present it with models of the places, because here the holiness is not only a story, it's something you can touch and you can go to.
We tour a new exhibition shining a light on Jerusalem and how this city of multiple layers comes together. Then, would you give up all your personal information for free if everyone else was going to do it too? Plus, we meet the duo behind an architecture practice in LA that's building libraries to help bring societal change to the neighbourhood. That's all coming up over the next 30 minutes, right here on The Urbanist with me, Andrew Tuck. So welcome to this week's Urbanist. City living is increasingly being shaped by technology. Stroll down any street in London, for example, and you'll find more people glued to their mobile phones than those with their eyes on the road. But as we turn into a society that feels the pressure to be constantly online, how is that changing the way we interact with each other? With the rise of smart cities on the horizon, privacy remains a core issue that many are trying to tackle. So just how much data should we be handing over? Carlo Ratti is the director of the Sensible City Lab at the MIT, and amongst other things, his work revolves around the future of urban living, and when it comes to technology, cities and data. And he has an interesting theory. He joined Carlotta Rebello to explain it all.
What is happening is really that in our pockets, we carry something such as a smartphone. And so, you know, I guess most of us have a smartphone. And so, for instance, since I woke up this morning, my smartphone most likely has collected a few thousand data points about where I've been, about what I looked at on the internet, about the people I called, about the text messages I received, about when I posted on Facebook, what I posted, and so on. And so that's doing kind of almost like a one-to-one copy of our lives. Of course, you know, this information could be interesting also for the city. When you look at Google, it tells you if you go to a shop, if you're supposed to be busy or not. But how do they know it? Well, they know it because they actually can monitor and measure every person who's getting to that shop. There are just a few states and a few companies who know everything about us, but we know very, very little about them. And this asymmetry is created like in a world where it's easy to have monopolies, so people use data against each other and so on and so forth. But what I'm saying is that this has very little to do with smart cities. This has to do with what has happened over the past 5 or 10 years with all the information we post on Facebook, on Twitter, with the smartphones in our pockets and so on and so forth. And that's really recording every second of our lives.
Now, obviously, when we're inside our own homes, we can kind of control that sort of information. You know, we see gadgets as, you know, Nest cameras and etc. that allow us from our phone when we're outside of the house to control exactly what's happening around there. Do you feel that it then is a matter of changing our attitudes to be more conscious as citizens that these companies that you mentioned know a lot about us and we don't know anything about them and we need to be wary of what you're giving in?
To be honest, it's a tough one because, you know, today you need to have a smartphone, or most people want to have a smartphone, and then, you know, there's no way to say I don't agree, because if you say I don't agree to the operating system, then you don't use a smartphone. And the same about Facebook. Or the same, yes, you're talking about the homes. Well, I use Siri in my home, but think about Siri or Alexa or Google Home. Yes, they allow you to control your home, but they also record everything that's going on inside the home. So, you know, certainly on some server, that information is stored and it knows when you're cooking because of the noise. It knows the things you're saying. It knows, you know, if you're having sex in your home. You know, all of that is the consequence of having like a microphone in your bedroom or in your kitchen. We've been trying to have this conversation at MIT twice. We convened a large forum. We called it Engaging Data. And so we invited the Obama administration. This was a few years ago. We had academics. We had companies who collect a lot of data and so on and so forth. And I think we should all have a conversation about this. Now, unfortunately, even GDPR goes in the right direction, but it's not going to solve it. Again, you know, what are you going to do? You know, if the terms in order to use your smartphone say that all the information that, you know, you're transmitting is somehow analyzed, then are you going to stop using your smartphone? Or, you know, if Gmail says in its term that all of your mail is being read by artificial intelligence bots, you know, are you going to stop using email? No, you cannot. So I think, you know, GDPR, unfortunately, could be part of the solution, but it's not the full solution. And let me tell you something a bit radical that for me today privacy has disappeared, but not uniformly. So it's the world we're living in as a society, and it's a world where just a few states and companies know everything about us, even know very little about them. And I don't know if it's possible to put the genie back in the bottle, but I'd like to tell you that I think that a better world, at least, would be a totally transparent world. So I think, you know, at least there's not this asymmetry. I'll be ready to live in that world where all this information now is collected and known and stored on just a few servers, secret servers on the cloud, at least to make it accessible to everybody. I think that at least would be a fairer society.
So you're saying that basically everyone should have access to everyone's information?
Well, it's better than just having a few people, a few big states or big companies have access to that information. You know, as humans, we went through that once upon a time. In hunter-gatherer society, at least if you believe what anthropologists write, then, you know, the concept of privacy doesn't exist and everything is shared inside the group. Even the most intimate part of our lives, you know, think about sex and so on, and all of that is shared in most hunter-gatherer society. So I think, you know, still that society, I think, would be fairer than the one when just a few people have access to that data, but not everybody.
How do you think then that the society we're currently turning into, with this lack of transparency and just a handful of companies knowing everything about everyone, how do you feel that is going to transform the generations to come when it comes to city living? Are the future generations simply do not know what privacy is?
Well, it's a very good question. Again, you know, I think things could evolve in many different directions. But somehow what you hear today in many cases is about, you know, well, you've got the younger generation, they post everything on Facebook, even things that tomorrow might haunt them back. Well, it turns out that as things become more transparent, also norms become more transparent, social norms. So basically, if we live an increasingly transparent life, also we tend to transform society into a more tolerant place. And think about something that people might not have wanted to make public. In the UK a few decades ago, think about touring and homosexuality at the time, you know, think about the extreme consequence one could suffer because of something like that. Well, at the same time, today, that's not an issue in most societies anymore. Then, of course, also the openness can be different and the need for privacy can be different. So somehow, you know, I think there's a relationship between what we share and also what we tolerate and accept in society.
Do you think that urbanists and planners can then build new cities or refurbish the way cities are built now to adapt to this no boundary society, this transparent society? Is there something that should be done when it comes to the built environment as well?
Well, I think, again, there's many ways to proceed. And I think we should all have a very important conversation here, because this is really going to fundamentally change the city. And we know that the big city is also a great place because in the past, many writers have been talking about the city as a place of anonymity, just because you're in the crowd. But in the crowd, it becomes a place where you're seen. But today with digital technology, it's not like that anymore. And if you look at what's going on in China, actually, we are contributing at the moment to the Shenzhen Biennale. And one of the topics we want to discuss is what is going on in China, where using new artificial intelligence called deep learning and using a lot of video footage, basically in every public space, you can identify everybody that's moving through the space just by looking at their face. And again, that's something that wouldn't be possible yet in Europe or the United States, but China is using it really to monitor life in the city and in buildings to an extent that would have been unthinkable just a few years ago. And so I think there's something very, very important that changes the very nature of public and private space. And we should all have a conversation. What type of society do we want to build?
Now, the way you're talking about this transparent society, that project in China that wants to monitor every citizen, you could easily understand why some people might say, wait a minute, this is kind of a utopian or more dystopian idea of city living. I don't want a random camera or through AI for someone to know always where I am. But that's when your argument comes in, that if everyone knows about everyone, then it's not a problem. It's just when it's a handful of people with knowledge.
Well, I'm not saying it's not a problem. I would say we still prefer that society versus society we're building today, where just a few big companies and big states know everything about us, but we know very little about them. So at least it would be a more reciprocal society with less monopolies and so on.
That was Carlo Ratti, who's the director of the Sensible City Lab at the MIT. And he was speaking to Monocle's Carlotta Rabello. This is The Urbanist. You're back with The Urbanist on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Tuck. Now, as the focal point of three religions, Jerusalem is truly a unique city. It's also one of the world's most contested. An exhibition at the Jewish Museum in Berlin tells the story of the city from Herod's time up to the present day, where daily life, religion and politics are all interwoven. Monocle's Henry Rhys Sheridan stopped by the museum.
A few days ago, I parked my rental bike outside the Jewish Museum in Berlin. I took a few steps inside and found myself teleported to Jerusalem. A major exhibition at the museum, Welcome to Jerusalem, looks at the politics, religion, and daily life that are intertwined in the Holy City. I met with one of its co-curators, Margaret Kampmeyer, who gave me a tour.
We are standing here in one of the most important rooms in the exhibition. It's dealing with the holy places, why Jerusalem is holy to three religions. And we thought to present it with models of the places, because here the holiness is not only a story, it's something you can touch and you can go to. So we had to look for models. And this model of the Haram al-Sharif, the holy district for Islam in Jerusalem, is one of the most precious models I have ever seen. It was made by Konrad Schick in the 19th century. He was a missionary in the beginning from Württemberg in Germany. This model was a commission by the Waqf, the institution, the Muslim institution for the holy places. And they wanted to have a model from this holy place to show it at the Vienna World Fair in 1973. And so he, as a first time for a non-Muslim, he was allowed to go into every building, not only into the Al-Aqsa Mosque and the Dome of the Rock, but into all the other buildings beneath and subterranean as well. And for the first time, this whole area was measured. And so this is very unique. It has nothing to do with imaginative descriptions and something like that, but it is really a measured model.
Most of the artifacts on display reveal the hotly contested nature of Jerusalem. A room of maps contains plenty of historical drawings of the Holy City. But among them were two cheap tourist maps that caught my eye. I asked Margaret about them.
They are a tourist map for everybody to orient in the old city to see the places, the holy places they want to see. They were edited by the tourism ministry of Jerusalem, and the first map only indicated very few Muslim places and very few Christian places, but lots of very tiny places of Jewish, and the big ones, of course, and Jewish holy places. And there were lots of protests from the Christian and Muslim side and from Israeli NGOs as well, that this would be a very deliberate disrespect of the other religions. And so after very, very strong protests from Christian organizations, they made a new map, now including the Muslim and the Christian sites, but without legend. And we think these two maps fit very well into the room, into a room with historical maps from the Middle Ages to the Enlightenment. Because you see, with these old maps, that Jerusalem always has been not only a geographical place, but a place of imagination.
The next room we go to is dedicated to Jerusalem's hotels.
We installed this room because the hotels during the Mandate period were the platform and the stage for political meetings, political talks from the Mandate government with the international players, with the Jews, with the Zionism, and with the Arabs. And because Jerusalem, as I just said, was growing so fast, they had not enough places for political acting. And so this was replaced by the lobbies and by the rooms of the King David and the American Colony Hotel. For example, the British government of Jerusalem, the British Mandate government, had not enough place to place all the offices, all the civilian government. And so they took the King David Hotel. It is why in 1946 the Irgun, a terrorist organization by the Zionists, made this bomb attack that many people think that this caused the British to retire from Jerusalem.
Jerusalem is steeped in history, but it's also a living city with 850,000 residents. Their lives are represented through excerpts from a documentary called 24 Hours Jerusalem.
It is a documentary by Volker Heise, a German filmer, and he invited a lot of filmers. He had 20 teams going to Jerusalem who should film from dawn to the night Jerusalem sites and make interviews with the Jerusalemites. We show this documentary for not 24 hours, but from the opening to the closure of the exhibition. And in the whole exhibition, in every room, we have in each room two of the interviews. For example, in the room about the pilgrimage, we have interviewed two pilgrims. And we have one interview from this tattooist. You see it from so many perspectives that we think people from today get a good information and a good idea of Jerusalem, what it is today.
For Monocle in Berlin, I'm Henry Rees Sheridan.
Thanks, Henry, for that report, which was co-produced by Natalie Galpin. Welcome to Jerusalem is on at the Jewish Museum Berlin until the end of April next year. Now, lastly, on today's show, we're going to head to Los Angeles to meet Jim Favreau and Steve Johnson of the architecture firm Johnson Favreau. The practice has been focusing on civic engagement and how to build better communities through architecture. Its main projects on this revolve around building and rebuilding libraries. Seen as the meeting point of the neighbourhood, they've been working across Southern California to turn around derelict structures into hotspots for the community. Jim and Steve spoke with Carlotta Rabello about the role architecture can have in shaping our cities and how libraries are alive and well and not going anywhere anytime soon.
The Free Public Library was first established almost immediately after the revolution and grew quickly from there. And a lot of it is founded on the philosophy that the democracy really can't thrive without an educated people. But it turns out it's not just a repository of books. And of course, that came to a kind of state of crisis at the end of the 20th century, and libraries were prepared for that. They always knew that they were more than a repository of books, really a place for people to gather, to learn from each other. The librarian was always seen as a resource of information and knowledge and a way to disseminate that knowledge among the community. That's one aspect of it. The other aspect of it is certainly before World War II, it was taken for granted that the buildings themselves should be wonderful places, grand places, places that are accommodating to community and to individuals. And we kind of lost touch with that for about a half a century. And it is our opinion that we're only now regaining our footing with regard to how the quality of the buildings themselves are crucial in the success of a community library.
Now, we'll talk in a bit about some of the projects you've done, specifically with libraries. But I would like first to hear your thoughts on that idea that you were just touching upon, which is, can someone through architecture, specifically when working with libraries, kind of bring some sort of change to the habits and the way people behave and view that building?
The library systems have realized that they really do have to compete for our attention. In other words, they really have to provide an environment that people want to or need to spend time in. I think nothing has really changed by our observation that people still in some cases, need a place to be and want a place to be with other people, whether they're studying alone or studying alone together or simply passing time prior to a business meeting. We have found in our practice that these libraries are an opportunity for people to have a place that they can extend their work, they can extend their research, and avail themselves of all of the services that exist in the building. But the key thing is the architecture has to be a place that encourages that. There are so many choices today. You can do this in the cafe, you can do it in the park, as you point out, with the new technologies. But librarians understand that providing the kind of environment that engages you and keeps you there is important. And that's really what I think has addressed the improving quality of architecture of libraries today.
Now, one of the interesting recent projects is the West Hollywood Library, which kind of helped transform an area that was otherwise neglected.
Yeah, that was an interesting project. It was right at the moment. It was before the iPhone, but after Amazon and Google. In the planning process and the design process, hearing from the community, which is, by the way, a very active community full of opinions, certainly willing to voice them to us, there was a lot of talk about the death of the library, how it is obsolete, and why are we doing libraries anymore when we have all these other resources? And we as architects had to respond, just as we are speaking with you about the quality of place that's so important, and there needed to be, particularly in that city, a place to gather that was an alternative to Mexican restaurants and dive bars and nightclubs. And it was a neglected part of the city. Well, West Hollywood itself is only 25 years old, formulated out of a leftover piece of property within the county of Los Angeles. And the location of the library is in the county park, a park that was previously owned by the county that got subsumed into the city, really had no attention paid to it forever. And so this really was, the project began by master planning the 8-acre site, and then the library became the first phase of the development of that master plan.
But what was key to that development, which is somewhat new for some Southern California cities, and it was certainly new for the LA County Library System, and in order to do that, in order to improve this park that this library was situated in, we really had to pursue a much more urban strategy of vertically stacking the library. LA County libraries were used to spreading out over large amounts of single floor areas, and that was simply not a possibility here with this community that just as importantly valued parkland. And so this did force a new space type, not unusual for Europeans, but certainly more unusual for Americans, going up with the library rather than spreading out horizontally.
And the benefit of that was you got a payoff at the third floor of the building. There's a pretty magnificently scaled room that commands views across the Hollywood Hills and across Los Angeles all the way to downtown to the east and across the city, West Hollywood itself, to the north.
Well, it's a very nice outcome of the project as well, precisely because of its stature within the city. And that really is an issue of just dimension. It really has become a civic center in its own right. It is a place that people in that community, which loves to demonstrate and march on any occasion, they gather there in front of the library, which we very much appreciate because we do generally believe libraries are a reflection of a community's values, their interest in learning and their engagement in civic life. And so we very much appreciate that we provided a place, an urban place, that is seen as the city's heart. It's seen as a place where they can gather, where they can protest, where they can stand on the steps of the library and essentially speak their mind. And that for us is gratifying because it really does solidify the position of libraries in civic life.
Now, you mentioned there three crucial things. First, that when approaching a project like this, how essential it is to, you know, hear out the community, get a feeling of what are their thoughts, even if it leads to some disagreements, is essential for the future of the project. Then that idea that it's perhaps better to build upwards, obviously in a controlled way, rather than to expand sideways, and the benefits that come from it. And then finally, that point of democracy and how libraries can be the hotspot for it and reflect the values of the people who are regulars. Can you say these are lessons that you're now taking with you to new projects that the firm is doing?
Absolutely. We're on our fifth or sixth community library now in Southern California. Every one of the communities is unique and every situation is unique, and they all have a different approach to how they democratize their communities. And that's one of course, the most interesting things about our lives, is we get to meet these communities and work with them in different situations. And the buildings themselves respond. So if you were to look at the array of libraries that have been built and are about to be built by us, you'll find that each one is unique. It's singular. It's really tailored to the people in place for whom it is designed. And yet we're also taking lessons across each experience and better able to apply them.
That was Jim Favaro and Steve Johnson of Johnson Favaro, and they were speaking to Carlotta Rabello. Well, that's all for this week's episode of The Urbanist. The show was produced by Carlotta Rabello and was edited by David Stevens. To play you out of this episode of The Urbanist, here's M83 with Midnight City. Thank you for listening, City Lovers.